Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. Before we begin our program, I just want to say a few words. We lost a great citizen over the weekend, in the last couple of days, John Priebus, who was a judge here in Baltimore. He went to City College. When I went to City College, he was a remarkable human being, a man of great integrity, a person who really was the epitome in many ways of what a judge should be in our society, and a brilliant mind and a very gentle human being who really thought deeply about the people before he let them go or sentenced them, and was just somebody who was one of our profound thinkers on the bench and as a citizen. And so our condolences to all of us for the loss of Judge John Priebus, to his family, and, of course, especially to Tony Keene, who's been the other half of his life for many, many years now. And we will let people know when services are, and if they come in the midst of our program, we won't be on the air that day because we have to be with the family at that moment when that happens. But we just want to send our condolences out to John Priebus's family, to Tony Keene, and all of us who lost a dear friend and colleague. Right now, we're going to start our conversation about a constitutional convention. Reminding you, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And if you're in the mood to watch, go on over to steinershow.org, and we're streaming our program live now on the web, and you can watch us and also participate there and see what you think. As long as I don't scare you away, you can watch the program. We are talking this hour with J.H. Snyder, who is a political scientist and president of isilon.org. And he has another website, Concon, C-O-N, capital C-O-N, capital C-O-N, dot...
Maryland Concon.
American Concon.
MarylandConcon.org.
And dot org. And we will be, you can after the show, you can attach that on our web and link it and see it. We're also joined by Senator Jamie Raskin, who joins us by phone. He's a Maryland State Senator from Prince George's, Montgomery County, Tacoma Park. And J.H. Snyder, welcome. And Jamie, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
My pleasure to be with you, Mark.
How are you doing, Jamie? It's been a long time.
Yes, well, I'm delighted to be back on your show.
Great. So let's talk about this. Is really, I think, an issue that we had a lot of calls on the other day when we just happened to mention it and talk about it on the air. And I want our listeners to come back to it at 410-319-8888. I mean, every 20 years, we have this possibility of having a constitutional convention made of citizens of the state of Maryland to rewrite, do whatever they want to change the Constitution of the state of Maryland, which is a 147-year-old document. Right now it has 47,000 words. There's a quote that was actually in the Washington Post that I found really interesting that I will share with you from Thomas Jefferson. He wrote in a letter to James Madison where he said, "The earth belongs to the living generation. Every constitution then and every law naturally expires at the end of 19 years. If it be enforced longer, it's an act of force and not a right." And so there's a lot of visceral feeling about this, but I think there's not a lot of understanding of what this means. And Jamie, let me begin with you because I was interested to hear that you opposed this charter amendment for calling for a constitutional convention, and I'd like you to lay out why first.
Sure. Well, first of all, in principle, I love the idea of a constitutional convention, and you know, as a professor of constitutional law, I mean, to me, this sounds like heaven. Getting to hang out with a bunch of other Marylanders and to redesign our constitution
right.
And do it from the ground up. But as always, the writing of a constitution is a political question. That is, it's got to be placed in the context of the times and the place that we're in. Now, the last time that we had one of these in 1967 and 68, which was really, in some sense, at gunpoint because the Supreme Court had ruled that our state legislative apportionment mechanism was unconstitutional because it violated one person, one vote. So we needed to get together. And the last time we did it, the voters ended up rejecting the handiwork of the convention, which I thought was really a pretty good document. But in any event, it cost $3.5 million. So, you know, if you translate that into 2010 terms, it's more than $20 million. I mean, even if we could contain it to something like $10 million, I mean, that's a rather extraordinary and agonizing number when you look at, you know, what's happening with cops and firefighters and public employees and essential public services. So I'm not saying I would never do it, and I'm not saying that it would necessarily be the wrong thing to do now, except that nobody's really presented a compelling logic for why we do need to do it now and why we can't handle in incremental fashion the way we do in almost every election cycle dealing with particular problems. I mean, I'm going to be the first to concede that our Constitution is a sort of ramshackle mess that's kind of, you know, continually pasting on new rooms and so on, and there's stuff in there about off-street parking in Baltimore. And
right.
So it's, you know, it's not a pretty picture. But on the other hand, it's working fine. I mean, we do have, you know, one of the best state governments in the country. And nobody, to me, has really shown a compelling logic for why we should do it, why the voters will support. So I would like to see a process leading up to a convention where we actually ventilate public discussion of the particular issues, because what can happen is you put a constitution out there and there are one or two things that people don't like, and then it sinks the whole ship, and then it, you know, it destroys the whole thing. Whereas right now, you know, we can put stuff on the ballot, as we have, you know, for example, the early voting constitutional amendment, which has worked great. Early voting, I don't know how you guys like it in Baltimore, but we love it in Montgomery County.
It's working here as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we can do in an incremental and an issue-specific way, rather than trying to, you know, sweep the whole table at once.
And so why do you think we need this constitutional convention and after 20 years of not having one?
If I could just start by saying I think you could not have picked a better person in Jamie to represent the no side. He's a real outlier when it comes to the Maryland General Assembly in terms of his intellect and thoughtfulness, and certainly he's a constitutional scholar, so he's well qualified to talk about the issues. We tend to approach this a little differently. He's a legal scholar by training. I'm a political scientist. We agree on a lot of issues on democratic reform. On this particular issue, we quite clearly disagree. I should also say that I was an undergraduate at Harvard. Jamie was there, and we both got our graduate degrees from Harvard University the same year, but I don't think I ever bumped into him. It's a big school. So with that, I'd like to talk a little bit here about why I think you should vote yes on this amendment. There are certain types of issues where a legislature has a conflict of interest with the public, a direct and blatant conflict of interest. Redistricting is a classic case where elected officials choose their constituents. Everybody agrees that's a serious conflict of interest. Term limits, another classic case where the public is overwhelmingly supportive of them. 70-80% of the public consistently supports term limits. We only have them, with one exception and an interesting exception, in states with the initiative that can bypass the legislature. The legislature won't do it. In Maryland, we have a governor with term limits. I'm in a county. The county executive has term limits. The school board has term limits. The county council, the school boards has term limits. The legislature will never vote for term limits. Legislative transparency, it's just awful in the legislature. It's such an embarrassment. It's unbelievable. There have been lots of attempts to rectify that problem. Jamie has actually been quite involved in some of those attempts. They just absolutely haven't delivered the goods. Ballot access, another classic case. There's a whole realm of these cases where you don't want to have elected officials determining the electoral system. So here, the existing systems, I agree, for most issues, the amendment process that we have, and we've amended that constitution more than 200 times since that constitution was created, more than one amendment a year on average since that was created, works fine, but not for these type of issues. So now a few other things I should say. You know, why was the CONCON created? It was created as a checks and balance institution. This whole idea that a legislature and elections are adequate to assure democratic accountability. One of the first things we teach our students in political science is the importance of America's checks and balance system. The founders wanted to create auxiliary institutions. That's why having an executive branch and a judicial branch to check the legislative branch. We have a system of federalism, of local governments with checks. And we have many, many other auxiliary checks and balances. And this is one of them. When George Mason argued vociferously for including in the national constitution, a constitutional convention process, he argued, and here I'll give you the words. It would be improper to require the consent of the legislature because they may abuse their power and refuse their consent on that very account.
Well,
it was a safety valve.
What I want to do, though, is kind of focus on why the real kind of reasons intellectually and viscerally why this is, works or doesn't work. I mean, the overwhelming, I think, sense in Maryland are two things. from people I've talked to and people who call in. Folks, I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. Do you plan to vote for this amendment to call for a constitutional convention? Do you plan to vote against it? Why do you think we need it if you do think we need that? Would you run for it yourself if it passed? What do you see in the constitutional convention, in our constitution, that makes you think we need to have a constitutional convention? In 1968, which was the last constitutional convention, someone wrote a book at the end of it calling it the process a magnificent failure, which we'll talk about in a bit. But the question is why? I mean, because viscerally, I think, Jamie Raskin, I'm going to turn it back to Jay Schneider. Viscerally, most people look at this in this time of a kind of populist uprising in our country, saying, yes, we do need it, because we have to keep people who elected officials' feet to the fire. We have to keep them accountable to us. And you have this unwieldy 47,000-word document.
Poorly written, also.
Poorly written, and written as a pro-Confederate document when it first came out. After the Civil War. So Jim, how do you respond to that? I mean, because that's what's going on here in many ways, whether it's the issue of term limits, redistricting, which is a huge piece that's going to come up in the next in this country, I mean, but in this state as well. So, I mean, talk about that, because you can throw out some intellectual arguments why it shouldn't be, but I think there's a real kind of populist sense of why it should be.
Well, right, and, you know, but I agree that we need some serious structural democratic reforms. I've pushed a number of them in the General Assembly. I mean, one was I teamed up with perhaps my most right-wing colleague, Alex Mooney, to introduce a bill that originally nobody liked and nobody thought had any chance, which was to require the state government to put online within 48 hours all state expenditures over $25,000. And people were saying to me, but that could be embarrassing. And I'm like, well, then why are we spending the money if it's embarrassing? And it ended up passing unanimously, because when you put the issue forward, eventually people are going to see the logic of it and nobody's going to want to be opposed to it. We also got through early voting to expand democratic access. We abolished a law that we had, again, that put us in the miserable company of, you know, 9 or 10, you know, ex-Confederate states, which banned voting by ex-felons for the rest of their lives, even when they'd had all other rights restored to them. So, you know, we gave people their right to vote back. So I think that we've been able to make progress both through the normal legislative channels and through the state constitutional amending process. Now, you know, the suggestion is that there is a certain kind of structural conflict of interest between legislators and the people on certain issues like, you know, term limits or, you know, ballot access. And again, you know, ballot access is an issue I've been involved in, even though I'm, you know, a dyed-in-the-wool true blue Democrat. I think it's absolutely wrong for the incumbent parties to use our power in the legislature to increase barriers to entry for third political parties and independents. And I've worked with you know, even Andy Harris, who's somebody whose politics I generally abhor, but we've worked together to try to lower the, you know, the petition, the signature requirement for the third parties to get on the ballot, and that's something I'll continue to fight for. The problem is, let's say that you created a constitutional convention around just a bunch of those issues, like term limits and, you know, signature requirements and things where you think there's a structural conflict of interest. The first problem is that I don't think that there's really a public mandate to do that right now. That is, we haven't had the preparatory political dialogue and discussion that would really allow us to crystallize those issues. But even if you did, some people are going to like three or four of them, and some are going to like one or two of them, and then there can be a campaign against the whole Constitution that will sink it in the end, which is what happened in 1967 or 68. So millions of dollars later and months after people have invested all this time, the whole product goes down because somebody's able to run a clever campaign against one particular aspect of it. For example, in 67, 68, one of the things that they had in there was to get rid of all elections for judges, to make judges, you know, purely appointed.
Right.
You know, I don't know whether that's populist or anti-populist or what have you, but that is something that I think today would sink it if that came back again, if we just sort of dusted off that old document. So I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, the constitutions succeed when they articulate and express a clearly held popular movement or popular sensibility that is at odds with the incumbent legislators. And, you know, I agree that there are times where the incumbent politicians act as a single party, regardless of what their label is, against the people. And, you know, in such a conflict, I would hope that I'm with the people against the incumbent party. But I don't think we have anything like that in terms of a political controversy that has crystallized at this point. And so I think now it would just be a waste of people's money and time to do it.
And so I think just respond quickly, Jay Schneider, why do we need it now? And what would be the purpose?
Well, I really have to address this little legal confusion. For example, they did in 1967 say have an up or down vote on the entire Constitution. They didn't have to, though. It could have broken down, and many other con-cons have done that. They made a strategic mistake. They thought it was going to pass without a problem. It was very popular. They had no money to support it, and they ran up against all sorts of groups. In my county, for example, there was the Anne Arundel White Council. It was the perception that this would help minority rights, and they went against it. In Baltimore County, the politicians didn't like it because it would have created single-member districts. So if you're in a three-member district and you're all – two of the three incumbents would have lost, they went around with – this was, you know, the 1960s. Baltimore was much more important then. You still had that, you know, white – all white neighborhoods in conflict. They ran around with those buses blaring, saying it would help the black community. That helped defeat it. What happens when you have a single up or down vote in modern politics with modern mass media is the opponents focus on the most controversial thing, and the whole thing goes down. So they wrote a great constitution. People agree. They reduced the size, the mess that we have at 40,000 words by more than a half, cleaned it up. But people didn't care about that. They focused on a few controversial things.
So the
notion that it's an up or down vote, if you break it into its components and put the controversial issues into separate amendments, you're much less likely to have that situation.
But the question is, though, the focus on succinctly is – if that's the historic case for the Constitution, the Constitutional Convention in 1967, and I wasn't living in Baltimore then, I was out of the city by that time and came back later, but I remember it very well, and it was full of a lot of racist attacks, people not wanting certain things happening in the state. It was the beginning, the end of the civil rights movement, segregation had just ended. It was a tumultuous time. We're in a different tumultuous time now, but it just as tumultuous on some levels. And so the question is, what would make this process any better than that process that seemed not to go anywhere? Why do we need it?
It was a very effective process. The mistake was not to have a substantial for campaign. So the legislature creates money to have a con-con, but there's no money to go out in the press and support it. The opponents, who are highly motivated, there were many politicians who felt put at risk by the postal. They went out and organized and spent a lot of money and focused on the most controversial things. If you break down the recommendations into multiple recommendations, for example, if you had an item about term limits, that would overwhelmingly pass. This is what we know. When you have a reasonable term limits provision, it's going to overwhelmingly pass. I think if we had an alternative redistricting proposal, you know, that would be very popular. When it comes to things like legislative transparency, just let me tell you the story of when this bill came up in the legislature. I called the House Ways and Means Committee Chair again and again, asking when it was going to come up, because I don't like the language, the way it was put. I think it's very misleading, the way it was put on the ballot. And she said, oh, I don't know. Eventually, I said, I knew she would stop taking my call. So I said, look, please tell me when it's going to come up so I can be there. And she said, well, she didn't promise, but she thought she'd be able to do it. I still called her up a week later. She didn't know. But then a week later, it came up, and she didn't call me. That's how the legislature does business. It's designed for insiders. They have awful notice. The simplest email notice. I mean, I come from the think tank world. We all give people notice to do things. The legislature does it, and they don't do it for a reason. They don't give you 72 hours to look at a bill for a reason. Look at Jamie. He's in Tacoma Park. The quality of their legislative information systems in Tacoma Park is so much better than the state legislature. Tacoma Park has 30,000 people versus almost 6 million. They webcast their meetings. They archive them. They index to the minutes. It's crazy.
But I think what you're saying, I hear what you're saying, and I don't think I disagree with a lot of what you're positing at the moment. The question is, what does that have to do with the Constitutional Convention? But let's open the phones. I mean, what would a Constitutional Convention do to ameliorate any of those things that you're talking about? And we'll come back to that. Let's go to the phones of 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts on Election Day, or perhaps this is the You have one more day when you can still vote in Maryland before Election Day. Did you vote for a Constitutional Convention? Did you vote for it? Did you vote against it? What are you thinking about doing on Tuesday? If you haven't voted yet, I'm one of those who's waiting to vote till Tuesday. What do you think? 410-319-8888. Keith, you're on the air.
How you doing, Mark?
Well, Keith, welcome.
Show. I consider myself a Federalist, and I really don't feel as though that having a convention, Mark, doesn't really seem like it. It doesn't really need a lot of some things need to be amended, but a full-on convention or something like that just seems like it's a little extreme, because really you leave yourself wide open to, well, if we can change this issue, if we can change one amendment, why don't we try to change this amendment? And it's a broad brush. And I just don't really think that, I mean, I just want somebody else's opinion that they think I'm going in the right direction, because I just really feel as though that it needs to be tinkered with just a little bit, but not a full-fledged convention, sir. I don't know.
What does that mean to you, tinkered with a little bit, but not a full-fledged convention?
I'm saying like this. There are certain provisions in having a constitution that we pose it by, even if you want to go back to the United States Constitution, more than made in 1776.
Yes.
Yeah, that's 2010.
Beginning, anyway.
I guess for the disenfranchised, you know, it needs to be changed in a lot of ways. But
I could add to that, Mark, you know, we have not had a constitutional convention nationally since the original one in Philadelphia, of course, and we have used the constitutional amending process to do it. And I think there's a good reason for it. I mean, any specific amendment itself is so complicated and has so many different ramifications and implications. I mean, take the 14th Amendment, you know, with equal protection and due process, or the 15th Amendment on voting rights. You know, each one is so complex and so controversial that it in itself unleashes a huge national discussion. But if you put 20 or 30 or 40 of them together, I think it becomes overwhelmingly complex and kind of mind-boggling to people, and people's instinct will be just to say, reject the whole thing, because, you know, they don't totally know what's in there. So I would say, you know, if we want to take the opportunity to actually have a constitutional convention in Maryland, then let's lay the groundwork for it by, you know, having Jay and other people who are interested in it set up some kind of commission that would begin to lay out sort of clusters of issues that we could begin to discuss and to begin to crystallize public consensus around it. But I think right now it would be an invitation for a free-for-all, and it would turn into kind of a circus where people would get elected on single-issue platforms to push, you know, this or that issue, whether it's, you know, against abortion or marriage for gay people or what have you. We know the kinds of people who are going to be most motivated to get out to get elected, and I think that totally changes the character of the experience.
Now, I'd like you, if you would, talk to the last point Jamie made, I mean, because about that potential for this happening with a 47,000-page document. And folks, Lamar and Bruce, we're going to come to you as soon as this comment's over. Looking forward to your thoughts.
So this idea that we could be opening up a Pandora's box, right, is certainly a classic argument. The basic response is that we've had 233 Constitutional conventions in American history. For the very small number of people that have studied them, they have clearly been, in overwhelming number of cases, a very positive part of our democratic process. We've had five in Maryland. Note that Jamie did not disparage what the last one actually recommended. Very judicious, very conservative, where the legislature has been sort of wild and out of control and adding constitutional amendments full of all sorts of special interest provisions, inconsistencies. The CONCON from 1967, as so many other CONCONs, slimmed it down, made a much easier to read document, a more modernized document. Many of the recommendations were actually later adopted by the legislature. It's a deliberative institution, so the whole idea is you can discuss things over a period of months, so you don't have to start off already knowing the answer. There are many checks and balances, arguably more with the existing legislature. First of all, you have to vote up or down on the ballot, so that's one. Then you have to vote for the candidates, like a regular election, too. And then third, all that the convention can do is propose ballot items. And then you get to vote a third time. There's so much more. When a CONCON deliberates, it's so much more visible than the legislature. The legislature's always sticking things in at the last second, like this 48-hour type of thing. You're so proud of that, the legislature. you know, it goes on for months. The media is there. It's covered. The level of accountability and checks and balances is so much great. You don't end up with these wild Pandora's things. If I could just give you an analogy.
A quick one, though.
Yeah. Where the legislature could decide to send the militia, you know, to attack Pennsylvania. They could pass legislation to kill firstborn kids, to abolish police departments. They don't do that because there are checks and balances. Yeah. The founders created a system that would be flexible. But it's got extraordinary checks and balance and democratic constraints on it, more even than the existing legislature, and they act responsibly. That's the history. Unless you can talk about those 233 conventions that have already happened, this is just all speculation, which doesn't bear out on historical circumstances.
Let's hear more of what our listeners are thinking at 410-319-8880. I'm going to come back and ask you both questions about what you just said. J.H. Snyder is political scientist, president of Iceland.org. Jamie Raskin is a Maryland State Senator, represents its district around Tacoma Park in Prince George's County and Montgomery County. The number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Lamar, you're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. You know, it's kind of funny because me and my girlfriend were actually reading this portion, and I was just wondering exactly what are they going to change in the Constitution? And did they do this 20 years ago, and what exactly did they change then? It's just too vague of a question to just say, and are we allowed to go to these conventions? Is it just delegates and senators? I mean, what's the rules? What's the criteria for that? I mean, could they give us a bigger explanation of how they're going to go about doing it? It's all these questions are really just too vague. I actually was reading it during lunch today.
You were reading the ballot question during lunch today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, to just kind of get
it's only one sentence. It's about as easy as you could possibly
But no, what you're saying is it's like the teacher's contract. It was too full of holes and vague to vote yes on it.
Well, you know, Mark, I would add to that. I think that that's the key point. I mean, this is a really big deal. I mean, to have a constitutional convention to create a new constitution is not another act of lawmaking. It's really the people designing or redesigning the government itself and our whole system of politics. And so, you know, his question is sort of my question, which is, what is the purpose for our doing this? Like, what's the compelling rationale for us getting together to do it? What are the controls in place that will guarantee some success both in the process itself, in the development of the document, and then in the ratification of it? And I guess all I'm saying is I agree completely with Jay that there are a lot of things that we want to take care of in that Constitution. We've been trying to take care of some of them, and I'm not averse at all to doing it in a sort of a sweeping, comprehensive way. But let's lay the groundwork for it in a way that makes sense to people so people can get on board and feel comfortable with the process.
We need to take a very brief break and come back. And
okay, Bruce,
And Bruce, when we come back, you'll be the next caller up, and we'll also hear what J.H. Snyder has to say in response to what Jamie just said. And we're going to I'm going to raise the issue you also just raised, Jamie, which is there are a lot of people who do think that we need to restructure the politics of this country and this state, and which is part of what this election is all about in general. So we'll talk about how that relates there. And the other part of Lamar's question were, what do we want to change in the Constitution? Why is it necessary to do that? And B, how do people get elected to get there? And who will these people be? 410-319-8888 is the number here. Support for WEAA is provided by Mid-Atlantic Neurosurgical Associates, MANA, a center dedicated to those who suffer from brain, spine, and pain disorders. With 3 Baltimore locations, MANA's team of pain management physicians and surgeons provide a wide range of sensitive and compassionate treatment options to improve the health and well-being of its patients. For more information online, manapaincenter.com or 410-601-8314. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Do we need a constitutional convention to rewrite the Maryland Constitution? Is the subject of today's program. It is one of the ballot measures, one of the several ballot measures that we don't talk about. There are ballot measures like this from 4 other states, and in every one of those states, It's not being paid attention to by the citizenry or the press very much. So we're talking about it this hour on the Mark Steiner Show with our two guests. Joining us by phone is State Senator Jamie Raskin. And here in the studio, J.H. Snyder, political scientist and president of Isilon.org. And you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You were about to start a thought when we went to break.
Yeah, there's a little bit of confusion about the law. There's the way it's written, which is very simply on the ballot, just a single sentence. But it refers to a provision in the Constitution which provides quite a bit more detail about how these delegates will be elected. They'll be elected in districts and in numbers identical to the way we elect the current General Assembly. It's a separate election.
Does that mean four people per district or three people per district?
It's four. It's 188 individuals would be a total throughout the entire state. So that's in the Constitution. The last time it was done, it was a nonpartisan election in 1967 and 68. I would recommend that. And then it's very clear there are at least three voting checks. You have to vote for it, which is what's coming up November 2nd to convene it. The delegates have to vote at a majority to propose anything to go on the ballot. And then third, the voters get to vote up or down on anything. The voters have proven willing over the years to vote things down if they don't like what a con comes up with.
Let me ask you this very quick question. I'm going to go to Bruce, our next caller, and Hank right after him. What is it that this constitutional convention, should it be convened, what could it do that we cannot do now? I mean, what would be the sense of having it? What could it actually do? What could it literally change if it existed? We'll start with G.H. and then we'll go to Jamie.
Well, I think redistricting is a good issue. Every 10 years, we redistrict in the United States. We're coming up to a period of redistricting. Unfortunately, the public doesn't get mobilized on redistricting until the plan comes out.
It's a governor's decision pretty much in Maryland with approval by the state legislature.
That's right. The legislature has control over who votes for themselves, which is the basic conflict of interest here. So we have a highly gerrymandered district. In Maryland, we primarily have the partisan gerrymander. So, for example, Jamie in his last election, the general election, won by 99% of the vote. In a similar district, the election is over in the primary vote. So what does this mean in terms of democracy? In my district, you can get 4% of the vote and win a seat in the state legislature. Well, how does that work? Well, I'm in a highly partisan gerrymandered district. So if you're a Democratic or an independent, you're disenfranchised. You have no chance in the general election. When you have, for example, five people running for two seats, in my district, you were able to win in the last election with 3,000 votes in a district of over 80,000 people. That's incredibly anti-majoritarian and
how would
undemocratic.
Change that?
It would make, instead of having these odd-shaped, highly partisan districts, they would be more balanced. Obviously, there's a number of different factors that go on into districts, but partisan gerrymandering has been one of the critical ingredients leading to our highly polarized politics today and the disenfranchisement of independents and the other party folks when they're in one of these gerrymandered districts.
Just be able to move this thing on. Jamie, let me let you jump in here because let me also just say that historically, your first campaign, though, was against a, was a longstanding incumbent that you fought hard.
But in the general election, he won by 99%.
Let me finish what I'm saying. Yeah. It was that you won. But go ahead.
First of all, I've only won one election so far. That was in 2006. And I did upset the president pro tem of the Senate, who'd been in office for 32 years. When I first announced, the Washington Post said my chances were impossible. And after I won, they said it was inevitable. The pundits are never wrong, you know.
Right.
And I got 67% of the vote in the primary, and it's true I got 99% of the vote in the general election because I had no Republican opponent. And again, I have no Republican opponent in Silver Spring and Tacoma Park. And by the way, my district mark is all in Montgomery County. There's no longer any part of Prince George's in it. But, you know, I think that the redistricting example is a perfect one because I think I probably have a far more sweeping and radical view of this than Jay does. I mean, I would move to a system of proportional representation, much like the way that corporations vote, cumulative voting or preference voting like they have in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which really would empower minorities. I don't hear Jay saying he favors anything like that. He's just saying he wants to maybe make...
I do like STV, by the way, just so. And I've actually suggested that STV in an editorial in the Baltimore Sun be used to elect the delegates. Go ahead.
But my point is a general one, though, which is, you see, we haven't even begun to discuss these things, and that's just one issue of perhaps a dozen that could be explosively controversial, and we haven't even begun to have that process yet. And so when the callers are calling in and saying, why, what's this about, this is a big deal to have a constitutional convention, why do we need it, I think that's where most people are, that, you know...
But, Jim, let me ask you this question.
I would say only 1% of the state even knows that this is on the ballot.
I understand that, but let me ask this question from what you just said. If and then I do have to get to our callers. But if that's exactly the point part of it, isn't it, that it will not be gotten to unless it's a constitutional convention, because it's so difficult because of the powers to be and the lobbyist power in Annapolis for these issues to even come to the fore to be discussed and debated.
I disagree with that. I mean, and, you know, my campaign for office is a great example. People said you cannot beat the political machine like that. I got 67% of the vote. If we want to do this, if we care enough about it, then let's put some positions down on paper and say, you know what, we're here at X and we want to move to Y, and that's why we want a constitutional convention, and let's have some discussion about it. But if we're just going to say, let's go and see what happens, it's going to be a complete free-for-all, it'll end up in chaos, and we've wasted millions of dollars. But let's start the discussion now so it's a meaningful referendum on something.
I think that's fear-mongering myself, but that's where I'm coming from.
Let's come back to this. Let's go back to the phones. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you've been waiting a while. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good evening, guys. Yeah, in one way, it's kind of a comment and a question. I'm surprised. It's so obvious that someone on the panel hasn't mentioned it. From the way I understand Maryland state law, I'm registered as an independent. But
right.
I'd vote for a Republican or Democrat. It doesn't matter what party I'd vote for. But the way the law is, in the primary, if I'm registered independent and there isn't an independent candidate running, I can't vote.
That's right.
Absolutely ridiculous. That favors the two-party system. Reform the political system. Just a subtle change could make a heck of a difference.
And the
main reason? The two-party system doesn't want to do that because they want it for their own advantage. They don't want a free system. They don't want it fair. Have a good evening.
You too. Thank you so much, Bruce. I don't know if isn't that particular thing Bruce
the
talked
system
about?
System disenfranchises independents. You vote with these gerrymandered districts as an independent. You can't vote in the primary. And your vote doesn't count in the general election, and it's all done. So, you know, what could be less democratic than that? I articulated in my district, you could win with 4% of the vote. I mean, everything that I know that Jamie stands for is that there should be this correspondence between voter preferences and seats. And we don't have that in Maryland. When he talks about proportional representation, that's what he's getting at. How can you make preferences more closely aligned with seats? And the redistricting process in Maryland makes that absolutely impossible. And the legislature is not going to address that problem because it's not in its self-interest to do so.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Hank. You're on the air.
How you doing, Mr. Stein?
I'm well. Welcome.
I was trying to wait for the muck, right? And I just had to join in on this, right?
All right.
Now, we've only been talking about this thing for the last 3 or 4 weeks. It's been an issue for a while, right? Why is it that every time we think somebody's sneaking something past us, nobody pays attention until it's right at the 11th hour? And then everybody wants to jump out and put something in front of you. I just think, and this is the second question.
Mm-hmm.
If we vote for this, right, who stands to lose the most?
That's my question.
Who stands to lose the most, and why is it always at the end, the 11th hour, things that we really need to know about, we get... They want to put in front of us like, look, you really need to be paying attention to this, to vote for this, right? But if you really wanted us to vote or know anything about it, why didn't you say something last year to give us some kind of, or 6 months ago, to give us 6 months to work up towards it?
Hank, you raised a really good issue. And Jamie Raskin, let you start as elected official first, then go to JH.
Yeah, no, I agree completely with that. I mean, we all stand to lose if we're going to spend millions of dollars in very scarce public money on a process that's not ripe yet, where we haven't really developed kind of the public understanding and the commitment to particular values and changes. I mean, and so, you know, I would say let's focus on some of these particular issues, like redistricting, and try to develop a serious, sophisticated public dialogue around it. There's a lot of education to do around it, and move the ball forward. But if you try to deal with redistricting and judicial elections and marriage equality and abortion and throw in 25 other of the most controversial issues anybody can think of, I mean, that's a recipe for chaos. And I think people instinctively understand that, which is why people are being kind of instinctively averse and conservative about it, and conservative in the sense of favoring democracy and what we've been able to build so far, but not wanting to allow it to be trashed. And so I think we need to have a much more serious process that would lead us to sweeping constitutional changes.
So I'd like to address, you know, who's behind this? I mean, what are the real interests and why fear-mongering is so central, and also why this is such a low-visibility type of issue. So obviously we've studied this, political scientists and legal scholars, in many different cases, because it's 14 states that have these that come up every decade or few decades. And what we have learned is legislators overwhelmingly oppose CONCONs, overwhelmingly, because it's a checks and balance institution, and they view it as a Pandora's box that might do something like redistrict or make the legislative process more transparent so outsiders have the same access to information as insiders, and we're not so surprised by things all the time at the last minutes or term limits. So they're not going to like it, but they're also not going to discuss it, because their best strategy is this passive-aggressive strategy, which is if you don't discuss the issue, most people will either not vote, which is the same as a no vote, or they'll vote against it because people are nervous about voting for something they don't really understand. The press won't cover it because the press relies on partisan cues. If you have a bipartisan if there's bipartisan ignoring of the issue, it's not going to get covered. So that's one set of interest groups. And then in the last few decades, both big business and big labor have been strongly opposed to constitutional conventions. If you look at who's been financing the no campaigns, whenever they're close, it's usually 100-1, 200-1 for the no campaign, and it's the big economic interest groups. Most recently, it's been big labor, but big business has also been a major factor and still is a major factor. But they have provisions that they want to protect in these constitutions.
Here's my problem with the conversation we're having so far. You know, I'm moderating the conversation. Maybe I should be doing a better job. I don't think anyone listening to this conversation right now even understands what it is we would get if we had a constitutional convention. What would we change? I mean, looking at the Maryland Constitution Declaration of Rights, it's so convolutedly written that you had to sit down for hours to even figure out what it says, mm-hmm. whether you're a lawyer or not. Mm-hmm. That there are such arcane things in this Constitution that, you know, that I just make no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Off-street parking rights in Baltimore City and many other absurd things around the state. So I don't think anybody really understands concretely what it would mean if we had a convention. Because on the other hand, what you're saying, J.H., I'll let you go first quickly and then go to Jamie, is the other part of the argument would be, okay, labor is against it, sometimes labor unions against it, power groups are against it. But because of the power of corporations in America right now, mm-hmm. and because money is equal to speech in mm-hmm. America right now, the wealthiest people, the largest corporations, the BG&Es of the world, the Constellation Energies and the rest, the Purdue's and the rest could dominate this conversation. The banks could dominate this conversation about who gets elected and what gets talked about. This is we're in a very precarious moment, and I think that A, that's one question, and B is nobody really understands what it would be that we're really changing that makes sense for something that could throw it open to anarchy. I think that's what people are hearing. Let you start, J.H., and go to Jamie.
Well, the reason these groups oppose it is they sense that this is a populist institution and where they can control the legislature, right? And the legislature is very much controlled by special interests on many issues like big business and big labor. Mm-hmm. This is, for them, a Pandora's box. They don't know what could happen, and they're much less trustful of this process than their ability to manipulate the legislature. So I think that's the most compelling evidence that it would work in the general public interest. The fact that these groups are strongly opposed to it and have spent millions of dollars in recent decades.
But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I don't think people yet understand why it is they should even be for this. Well, what do you get out of it?
With redistricting, it's the consequences of redistricting. You have much less competitive campaigns, much higher barriers to entry, so you have less capable people in general that run and will be more likely to avoid issue. And you have this polarized set of lawmakers and legislatures today where you have one side and the other. There's no middle. And it's all posturing. It's hard to effect compromise. The things that you go listen to any candidates to talk about, oh, I'm going to reach over to the other aisle and we're going to compromise and whatnot. The system of redistricting conspires against that because you have people that are on the far left or on the far right that win these seats now. And that conspires against the type of legislature that we would like, which is highly deliberative and can compromise and move things forward.
And Jamie Rask, let me ask this question. I think one of the reasons that you might see an outpouring for this Constitutional Convention is because there's a popular sense that maybe it's what you were saying, J.H., I don't know if it's right or left so much as it's because there's a lot of people who are middle of the road that are sitting in that state legislature, but that it's the power of the lobbyists. The power of who has the access to the ears and minds of the state legislators, Senate and House of Delegates, and people do not feel included in that, which is one reason this might fit, one of the reasons this might pass.
Well, we clearly need a federal constitutional amendment, if not a convention, to accomplish it, which would declare that a corporation is not a person for the purposes of political participation in the United States. I mean, that accords with the views of about 75 or 80% of the American people who are absolutely outraged by the Citizens United decision. So, Mark, I think you're right. I mean, if you could identify one issue having to do with basic constitutional politics today that unifies the public, it's that corporations or CEOs should not have a First Amendment right to take money out of the corporate treasury to put into partisan election campaigns. So, I mean, that should be the focus, I think, of constitutional anger and change at this point. But, you know, look, if this were to pass, I would be, as a passionate constitutional scholar and citizen, I'd be the first one out there writing my own constitution, saying, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to take 3 weeks out, I'm going to write my own constitution, and I'm going to get out there, I'm going to try to hustle it and sell it to people. But I think those people who want people to vote yes now should have done this, as a number of callers were saying, 2 or 3 years ago. They should have said, here's what the problem is, or here's what the cast of problems are, and here's where I think we should go. But in other words, it's not a ripe situation to have a constitutional convention. I think it's really a recipe for reproducing the kind of partisan division and chaos rather than a deliberative process that, that Jay was sort of condemning in our current legislative politics, because people are going to be elected by the exact same legislative districts. You're going to have basically the same political organizations and coalitions involved in getting people elected to it, and you're certainly going to get, you're going to pull out the single issue groups, so you'll have the pro-choice versus the pro-life, and then the pro-gay rights versus the anti-gay rights. And I mean, it's not like you're going to have a completely new citizenry that's suddenly going to appear at the Constitutional Convention. It's going to reproduce a lot of the worst and kind of most divisive problems that we've got, unless we lay the groundwork in a very shrewd and sophisticated way by saying, here's the changes that we should make. And, you know, I think we should have 10 different drafts of a constitution out there and people debating them and discussing them, and then we could do it. But right now, it's just way too early.
Well, when you just said that, and I'll let J.H. come back very quickly, we only have a few minutes left, how would you do that, Jamie? How would you get the process you described?
Yeah.
How could that happen?
Well, I mean, how has it ever happened in U.S. history or even in Maryland's history? I mean, you know, people have gotten together to do it and say, we need a constitutional change to make certain that women can vote, that African Americans can vote. Or we need a constitutional change to say that we should be able to tax corporations or have a progressive income tax. And then that's a political issue and it's debated and people determine whether it's significant enough and substantial enough that we need to amend the Constitution to do it. And then either it's done on a single constitutional amendment basis, which is the way it's generally been done, or on the most extraordinary occasions, call a constitutional convention. But I don't think that we should call a constitutional convention just to see what happens. And there's a little bit of that feeling to me now about, you know, those people who are favoring it.
Go ahead,
Jay. Absolutely not. It's focused on this narrow set of issues where the legislature is deadlocked and just not going to solve the issues in any reasonable time. One of the critical questions here is how deliberative a body is a constitutional convention. It's a highly deliberative body, and it has ample time to address these, because if the public, for example,
supports a yes vote, it'll be probably 2 years before it's on the ballot to actually vote for the delegates. So what happens in that 2 years is we really do have 2 years to discuss it. And generally, nonprofit organizations will create commissions to address it and make all sorts of recommendations. So by the time it actually convenes, which wouldn't actually happen for at least 2 years based on the past, there will have been lots of time. And then even after it convenes, it will have a period of months for extensive deliberation, far more than the legislature. If you actually study how the Maryland legislature works, it ramps things down. They don't publicize them. There's almost no deliberation. The quality of the legislation is often awful. It's unbelievable what often comes out, the lack of thinking about the details and their ramifications, and no time for public comment. I mentioned, you know, I want to go to hearings. There's no notice. They make it as hard as possible for me, unless I'm willing to pay a couple thousand dollars to buy a proprietary database to let me know when things come up. This is so much more of a deliberative process than what we're familiar with. I think that's just a bogus type of argument. It doesn't mean that we have perfect deliberation in any process, but I think compared to, say, the initiative, this is a vastly superior way to deal with conflict of interest issues in a highly deliberative way.
Jamie?
But I would have high hopes for any constitutional convention that we do. And, you know, I should say, like, on the political transparency point, of course, you know, I've been deeply involved in that issue, and there were a series of political transparency and legislative transparency reforms that were pushed through in the last session, and so we are moving forward on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say across the board, there are much more reform-minded people getting elected to office who want to open up our government and, you know, make it more accessible, more transparent, and more responsive to the people. And, you know, I'd be the first one to say, let's go ahead and do a constitutional convention if I felt that we'd actually laid the groundwork for it and done homework and had people understand it. But right now I'd be shocked if 1 or 2% of the people in Maryland even knew this was on the ballot before they show up, much less understand what the issues are.
And I think that somebody wrote an email, it's not about this question, but it shows you just how confused people are. And we're going to try to answer this question for Maxine and other listeners maybe by Monday when we come back, or tomorrow if we can. She says, I've been studying my ballot to early vote and have some difficulty in getting the answers to a question on state question three constitutional amendment qualifications for Baltimore City Orphans Court judges. She said, one, what are the current qualifications for an orphan court judge outside of Montgomery and Harford counties? Two, why is the question only specific to Baltimore City and not the entire state of Maryland? And three, what is meant by in good standing? So I don't know the answer to those questions, and I'm fairly astute at these things. And so people don't understand what these questions are about because the information is not readily available to the citizens to understand what they're voting on.
Yeah. Just you mentioned Orphans Court. One of the recommendations was to abolish Orphans Court in the last CONCON. So you had all those groups opposed to a yes vote. And they made the mistake also of some of the key local elections people. I thought there were too many elected positions in Maryland, these obscure positions, but they all mobilized against the yes vote and spent money and were well organized.
And without answering, without saying whether you're for or against it, how would you answer, Maxine, Jamie?
Well, that's a deeply complex issue that the
yes.
General Assembly has been wrestling with. Go to the League of Women Voters website, which has a good analysis of what's at stake there to get in the details. But it's a great example of how even on something very specific like that, it's incredibly complex. And so, you know, we're biting off a lot more than we can choose if we say we want to develop a whole constitutional convention without people understanding what's really at stake.
You don't need a law degree to run for Orphans Court. I actually think you should need a law degree, but you don't.
Well, that's not a position on that because nobody to oppose you. There's other people who say maybe that's still a problem. We have too many lawyers doing this and not enough real citizens. Not that lawyers aren't real citizens, of course. Jamie Askin, it's been always a pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you so much, my friend. Good to talk to you.
It was good fun.
J.H. Snyder, great to meet you, and thank you for joining us on the air today.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll connect to your websites, CONCON,
MarylandConCon.org,
on our website.
Yeah, thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. When we come back, We're going to have a fascinating conversation, I'm sure, with Claude Anshin-Thomas, a Vietnam veteran, a combat veteran who wrote the book At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace. A man who fought in Vietnam, went through post-traumatic stress and more, met Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Buddhist monk, changed his life, but really has written this contemplative work on what it means to wrestle with our suffering and stop violence in this world. So stay with us for that. We'll be right back. Don't go away.